I want to continue in volume two. And in our last segment, we began reading September the 1st, 1899, where Louisa was given an absolutely extraordinary obedience that is costing her her life in order to try and respond to. So I want to pick up from where we left off. So having shed most bitter tears for the whole day, Louisa said, at night I found myself in my usual state, my always kind Jesus came, and I, forced by obedience, said to him, Lord, do not come, for obedience doesn't want it. And he, sympathising with me and wanting to strengthen me in the sufferings in which I found myself, with his creative hand marked my person with a large sign of the cross, and then he left me. In other words, he agreed completely, because he's going to explain to her, I am obedience. He said, I am faith, I am hope, I am love, I am grace, I am obedience. He is our everything. So Louisa said, who can describe the purgatory that I was in? And what is more, I was not allowed to fling myself towards my highest and only good. Ah, yes, I was forbidden to ask and to long for Jesus. Can you imagine? Ah, the blessed souls in purgatory are permitted to ask. They fling themselves, they pour themselves out towards their highest good. They're only prohibited from taking possession of him. But I was deprived also of this comfort. So all night long, I did nothing but cry. When my weak nature could take no more, adorable Jesus came back in the act of wanting to speak to me. And I, remembering the obedience which wants to reign over all, immediately said, my dear life, I cannot speak. Please do not come, for obedience doesn't want it. If you want to make your will understood, go to them. And while I was saying this, I saw the confessor, and Jesus, drawing near him, told him, this is impossible for my souls. I keep them so immersed in me as to form one single substance. So much so that it is no longer possible to distinguish one from the other. So Jesus is speaking about the extraordinary oneness between himself and Louisa, and indeed other souls who have reached this level. Put Galatians 2:20 there, I no longer live, Christ lives in me. It's like when two substances are mixed together, one transfuses into the other. And afterwards, if anybody wanted to separate them, it would be useless, even just to think about it. Like if you put two glasses of water together, it's totally impossible to separate them into the two original glasses, because the waters in both glasses have now completely become one. So having said this, Jesus left, and Louisa said, I remained in my affliction greater than before. My heart was beating so very strongly that I felt that my chest would actually crack. After this, I cannot explain how I found myself outside of myself. Now, it is well known that people experiencing severe torture have an out-of-the-body experience. In other words, the soul leaves the body in order to try and survive the experience. And this explains the level at which Louisa is suffering here, that she has an out-of-the-body experience. And forgetting, I don't know how, about the obedience I received, I wandered through the vault of the heavens, crying, shouting, and searching for my sweet Jesus. All of a sudden, I saw him coming towards me, throwing himself into my arms, all burning and languishing, because the need for each other is great. Like any two people in love. But soon I remembered the command received, and I said to him, Lord, do not want to tempt me this morning. Don't you know that obedience doesn't want it? And he said, the confessor sent me, and this is why I came. Louisa said, it's not true. Are you perhaps some demon who wants to deceive me and make me fail in obedience? And Jesus said, I'm not a demon. And Louisa said, if you're not a demon, let us make the sign of the cross to each other. And we both signed each other with the cross. And then I continued saying to him, if it is true that the confessor sent you, let us go to him so that he himself may see whether you are Jesus Christ or a demon. And then I will be sure. So we went to the confessor. And since Jesus was a child, I placed him in the priest's arms, telling him, Father, look yourself. Is he not my sweet Jesus? Now, while Blessed Jesus was with the priest, I said to him, If you really are Jesus, kiss the hand of the confessor. In my mind, I thought that if he was the Lord, he would accept the humiliation of kissing his hand, while if he was a demon, he wouldn't. And Jesus kissed it, though not to the man, but to his priestly authority. This is extremely important. After all, Jesus is God. God doesn't have to bow to any creature. But it was the priestly authority that was given to the man that Jesus acknowledged. In this way, he kissed it. After this, it seemed that the confessor was pleading with him to see whether he was a demon. And not finding him as such, he gave him back to me. But in spite of this, my poor heart was unable to enjoy the embraces of my beloved Jesus because obedience kept it as though bound, hampered. More so, since there was not yet a contrary order. So it did not dare to pour itself out, not even to say one word of love. So here you're dealing with heroic obedience at the highest possible level. O holy obedience, how strong and powerful you are. I see you before me in these days of martyrdom like a most powerful warrior, armed from head to foot with swords, darts and arrows, filled with all those instruments which are apt to wound. And when you see that my poor heart, tired and down, wants to be cheered, seeking for its refreshment, its life, the centre to which it feels drawn as by a magnet, looking at me with a thousand eyes, you wound me from all sides with mortal wounds. Oh, please have pity on me and don't be so cruel with me. So now we have an extraordinary ode to obedience that only somebody at the level that Louisa is at would be able to make. But as I was saying this, the voice of my adorable Jesus is making itself heard in my ear, saying, obedience was everything for me. And I want obedience to be everything for you. Deuteronomy 13:4. Obedience made me be born. Obedience made me die. The wounds I have on my body are all wounds and marks that obedience made for me. I want to give you 1 Samuel 15:22. Obedience is better than sacrifice. I want to give you Jeremiah 7:23, Acts 5:29. And of course, you've got the whole of John's gospel. I'll just give you a few verses. John 5:30. John 8:28 and 29, John 12:50, and John 14:31. Now, John 14:31 says, I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me. So he continues with his ode to obedience. With reason you said that she's like a most powerful warrior, armed with all kinds of weapons which are apt to wound. In fact, in me, she, that is obedience, left not even a drop of blood. Obedience tore my flesh to pieces, dislocated my bones, while my poor heart, exhausted and bleeding, kept looking for a relief from one who would have compassion for me. Acting with me as more than a cruel tyrant, only then was obedience content when she sacrificed me on the cross and saw me breathe my last as a victim of her love. And why was this? Because the office of this most powerful warrior is to sacrifice souls. Therefore, she does nothing but wage a fierce war against those who do not sacrifice themselves completely for her. Now, the word that's the problem there is completely. Most of us will do an obedience every now and then, but to sacrifice yourself 100% is a different subject. So obedience does not care whether the soul suffers or enjoys, whether she lives or dies. Her eyes are intent on looking at whether she wins. Because in other things, she does not meddle. So the name of this warrior is Victory. Who would have believed that you could rename obedience as victory over the soul? So I want to give you Revelation 2 and 3. Because there are many examples given to you in these chapters in which those who overcome and are victorious will receive all kinds of prizes from God. So the name of the warrior of obedience is Victory, because she concedes all victories to the obedient soul. And when it seems that she dies, then does true life begin. So self dies, because obedience kills the self and the selfishness and the ego, and true love and true life are born in us. What greater thing did obedience not concede to me? Through her, I conquered death, I defeated hell, I released man from his chains, and I opened heaven. And like a victorious king, I took possession of my kingdom, not only for myself, but for all of my children who would profit from my redemption. Now, notice all don't profit. Some people just cast it aside. Ah, yes, it's true that she cost me my life, but the name obedience resounds sweetly in my hearing. And this is why I have so much love for obedient souls. So here Louisa realizes that she is doing her PhD in this extraordinary experience of obedience. And then she says, I continue from where I left. Because the Jesus' explanation of obedience is now finished. After a little while, the confessor came. And when I said to him what was said above, he renewed the obedience that I should continue the same way. And I said to him, Father, at least permit me to give my heart the freedom to ask for Jesus. For then when he comes, I will do the obedience and say, do not come, I cannot converse. And then the priest said, do your best to stop him. And when you cannot, then give him the freedom. So there I want to give you the book of Sirach, chapter 2, a most wonderful chapter, which begins by saying, my son, if you desire to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for an ordeal. For gold is tested in the fire and chosen people tested in the furnace of humiliation. This is where Louisa is right now. So September the 2nd, 1899. Still the same obedience, but a little milder. So with this obedience, a little milder, it seemed that my heart from being dead began to live again a little bit. But in spite of this, it did not cease to be tortured in a thousand guises. In fact, when obedience would see that the heart would stop a little longer in search for its maker, almost wanting to rest in him because its strength was exhausted, she would swoop down on me and wound me all over with her claws. And then, having to repeat that refrain when blessed Jesus would make himself seen, do not come, I cannot converse, for obedience doesn't want it, was this not the most atrocious and cruel martyrdom for me? Then, as I was in my usual state, my blessed Jesus came and I manifested to him the command received. And he went away. Only once, while I was saying to him, do not come, for obedience doesn't want it, he told me, my daughter, keep the light of my passion ever before your mind. Now, if Louisa keeps the passion of Jesus before her mind, she will be able to obey much, much easier than before, because she will realize just how far Jesus went in obeying the Father. For in seeing my most bitter pains, Yours will seem little to you by comparison. And in considering the cause for which I suffered so many immense pains, which was sin, your little defects may seem grave to you. On the other hand, if you do not reflect yourself in me, the littlest pains will seem heavy to you, and you will hold grave defects as nothing. So notice that there is something that has got to change in Louisa, and that is her perspective of things. So let's read that again. So Jesus said, if you keep the light of my passion before your mind, and if you see my most bitter pains, yours are going to seem much smaller, naturally. And when you see that I suffered because of sin, your little defects, which of course added to the passion, will seem grave to you. But if you don't do that, if you do not reflect yourself in me, in the passion, Jesus said, the smallest pains will seem heavy to you and the defects will seem to be nothing. Oh, boys. Now, this is us. When we see the defects in ourselves, we excuse ourselves. Oh, I was tired, or I was under pressure, or I was under stressed, or whatever, whatever, whatever. And we don't realize that we've got to conquer ourselves and to let the Lord purify us at a very deep level. And the way to help us to do this is to keep our mind on the passion. Hence, the Lord wants us to be doing the hours of the passion every single day. Because in doing them every single day, then what Jesus suffered for us is actually before our eyes, and we won't have things out of perspective. Then Louisa says, after a little while, the confessor came, and when I asked him whether I was still to continue that obedience, he said to me, no, you can tell him whatever you want and keep him as much as you want. It seems that I have been set free now, now that I don't have to deal so much with this warrior so powerful. Otherwise, this time he would have been strong enough to give me death. However, he would have let me make a great gain because I would have united myself to my highest good. That's 2 Corinthians 5 verses 1 to 10. I would have been united forever, not at intervals, and I would have thanked him. Not only this, but I would have sung to him the canticle of obedience, that is, the canticle of victories. Now let's look at obedience from a completely different angle. That obedience is the canticle of victories, and I would have laughed at all its strength. But of course, the priest doesn't want her to die. So when he sees that she's at the extremes, then he removes the obedience from her so that she won't die. But I'm saying this, a radiant and beautiful eye has appeared before me, and a voice saying, and I would have united myself with you and would have delighted in laughing because that would have been my victory. And of course, the voice is Jesus. And Louisa said, oh, dear obedience, after laughing together, I would have left you at the door of paradise to say to you goodbye. No longer see you again. To have nothing to do with you anymore, and I would have been very grateful not to let you in. So Louisa is very relieved, and she's in no doubt whatsoever that she doesn't want to go through this again. Okay. Jesus has more to tell her about obedience, of course, because someday he's got to say to her, I am obedience. So September the 5th, 1899, this is a very important message. That Jesus says he operates in us little by little, sip by sip. We couldn't take it any other way. This morning I found myself in such disheartenment, Louisa said, and I saw myself so bad that I made myself and rendered myself unbearable. Oh, sometimes we're like that, don't we? We get out the wrong side of the bed and somehow we're unbearable to ourselves and everybody else. It's very charitable to tell people to give you space on a day like that until you can become more civilized. I told Jesus, when Jesus came, I told him of my pains and the miserable state that I was in. And he said, my daughter, do not want to lose heart. In other words, don't put your will into it. This is an emotional state you're in, but if you put your will into it, it's going to be serious. It is my usual way to operate perfection little by little. Now, beside that, put Ephesians 2:10, we are God's work of art created in Christ Jesus. And the artist, of course, does his painting or sculpture in piece by piece. And the picture actually develops. And he might say, oh, I need a little bit of extra here or a little bit of extra here to touch up the picture. Now, we've already heard that Jesus did some touching up on Louisa's soul as well. So it's like as if we are a canvas and we are nailed to a frame. That's the cross of our lives. And the Lord is working on us piece by piece. It's my usual way to operate perfection little by little, and not everything in one instant, so that in seeing that the soul is always lacking something, the soul may push herself and make all efforts in order to reach what she lacks, to please me more and to sanctify herself more. Now, you can see there that you don't become a saint by accident. You have to want it and you have to work at it. I want to give you Leviticus 19:2. You shall be holy, for I am holy, says the Lord. And Jesus continued, and I, drawn by those acts, the efforts that you make, and in this way, a commerce fully divine forms between the soul and God. Commerce means a movement from one to the other. You give and I give. That's the commerce. In the world, I give you some material thing and you give me some money. But this commerce with God is fully divine. Otherwise, if the soul possessed within herself the fullness of perfection and therefore of all the virtues, she would not find any way to strive. And the Lord wants us to strive and to make efforts on this earth. She wouldn't strive and to please me more. And so the tinder with which to start the fire of divine love between the creature and her creator would be missing. Isn't that interesting? So it's our very knowledge of our defects and our desire to overcome them and the struggle to actually try and become what the Lord wants us to be that enables this divine fire of love to be kindled in us. So September the 9th, 1899, again we speak of the three great ones, faith, hope and charity. Jesus continues to come with a look all new. It seemed that the trunk of a tree was coming out of his blessed heart, which contained three distinct roots. This trunk was leaning out of his heart into mine. And coming out of my heart, it formed three beautiful branches loaded with flowers, with fruits, with pearls and precious stones, shining like most refulgent stars. Now, you can see here that Louisa is trying to describe something spiritual and she mixes her metaphors in what we would call an impossible manner. How can you have flowers and fruits and then precious stones and then stars? You've shifted completely into different spheres there. Now, seeing himself in the shade of this tree, my loving Jesus enjoyed himself completely. More so, since many pearls were falling from the tree, which formed a beautiful ornament for his most holy humanity. While in this position, he told me, dearest daughter of mine, the three roots that you see, which this tree contains, are faith, hope and charity. This is the foundation of the spiritual life. Now, Jesus described himself as a tree in different ways in the gospel. For example, in John 15, he said, I am the vine and you are my branches. Okay. He also compared himself to, he compared his church to the mustard tree that grew into a great height. The fact that you see this trunk coming out of me and entering into your heart means that there is no good that souls possess which doesn't come from me. So there's your John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. Also want to give you John 14:6, Ephesians 1:3-14, Ephesians 2:4-10. Then Jesus said, after faith, hope and charity, the first development of this trunk is to make known that everything good comes from God. That creatures have nothing of their own, but their nothingness. OK, now look how often he comes back to this question of our nothingness. We have literally nothing of our own but our nothingness. and that this nothing does nothing but give me the freedom to enter into them and to do what I want. You see, God created the entire universe out of nothing. He doesn't need any material to work on. If he needed material, he is not the creator. And so in order to create something completely new in us and to do a completely new work, because God does not want to patch. You heard Jesus saying that Christianity was not a patch on Judaism. He doesn't want to patch. He doesn't want to fix up. If you read the scriptures, you find that in every dispensation that God gave to humanity, we failed him in every one of them. But each time we failed, he did something new and he did something greater. And so as you go through the Old Testament and you have the perfection of the Garden of Eden and then man failed, he gave them the time of the law. And then finally, he gave us redemption, just to give you a quick idea how to look at it. And so he said, let's read this again. Faith, hope and charity open our eyes, enable us to see the way God sees. So what does the soul see? She sees that everything comes from God. Everything all around us and inside us and outside of us. Everything comes from God. That creatures have nothing of their own. All they have is their own nothingness. And that this nothingness gives God the freedom to create. That's why I think that one of the greatest things in this divine will spirituality is our nothingness. And we need to say to the Lord at every moment of our day and night, Lord, I throw my nothingness into your allness so that you have the freedom to work with me in your will. However, there are other nothings, that is, other souls who make opposition with their own human will. Now, this is the problem with us nobodies, that even though we are complete nobodies, that we oppose God with our own will. And so the big challenge in the journey of divine will is to put our own will aside and to allow the Lord to take over. So, because this knowledge is lacking, the trunk produces neither branches nor fruits nor anything that's good. Now, what he's saying is, in some souls who don't allow the great foundation of faith, hope and love to rule their lives, then they pit their own will against God and they don't produce any spiritual fruits. The branches which this tree contains, with all the apparatus of flowers, fruits, pearls and precious stones, are all the different virtues that the soul can possess. So all the description above of flowers and fruits and precious things, they're all the different virtues that should be manifest in a soul. Okay, but they're only going to come to fruition if we put our own will aside and let God's will work in us to produce these fruits. Now, who has given life to this beautiful tree? Certainly the roots. This means that faith, hope and charity embrace everything and contain all virtues, so much so that they are placed there as the basis and the foundation of the tree. Now, this is the thing you really, really need to underline this and make sure that you get the message that faith, hope and charity are the foundation of this spiritual life. Without them, we're going literally nowhere. Without them, no other virtue can be produced. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 13. And 1 Corinthians 13 describes love. And at the very end, which is verse 13, we're told that now faith, hope and love are what last, and the greatest of these is love. So the very next verse, which is 1 Corinthians 14, 1, St. Paul says you must want love more than anything else. So you've heard me already say that the fullness of this spirituality is divine will and love. OK, the very important passage there. Louisa says, I also understood that the flowers signify the virtues, the fruits, the sufferings, the precious stones and pearls, suffering only out of pure love for God. Now, at the very end of it, she describes why there are different descriptions of things. The fruits are sufferings. The precious stones and the pearls are suffering that's done only out of pure love for God. So there are different ways of suffering, and the victim souls are the ones who are famous, as we say, take out their PhD in suffering for love of God. The rest of us have to learn how to do it. This is why those pearls which were falling formed a beautiful ornament for the Lord. Now, while sitting in the shade of this tree, Jesus looked at me with tenderness all paternal. And taken by a surge of love, such that it seemed he could not contain it within himself, he embraced me tightly and began to say, how beautiful you are. You are my simple dove, my beloved dwelling, my living temple in which I am pleased to delight, united with the Father and the Holy Spirit. Now, that's a huge summary of scripture. I want to give you Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse 1, 1 Corinthians 3:16, John 14:23. And Jesus reveals here that what he's trying to do in us in this divine will spirituality is create a temple for himself on the earth where he can live and where he can reign, and he can reach out to save other souls. So he's looking for us. We're absolutely nothing, but we can give him this space. And why don't we give it to him, since we are nothing and we can do no good of ourselves? It is such an incredible privilege to give him this space. So make sure you say, I throw my nothingness into your allness every nanosecond of my entire life, so that you can have your dwelling in me, and that through me you can reign upon the earth and save souls. What a wonderful privilege. So Jesus continues to speak to Louisa. Your continuous languishing for me relieves me and refreshes me from the continual offences that other creatures give to me. Other creatures meaning other human beings. Know that the love I have for you is so great that I am forced to hide it in part, so that you may not go mad and may live. Now, he's saying something very important here. One of the reasons why Jesus doesn't show himself to the rest of us is that if you go into ecstasy, ecstasy means that you're going out of yourself to him. And if you realize just how much he loved us, we would go out to him forever. We wouldn't stay. What would you have to stay for? This earth is nothing if you have experienced the incredible wonder of the love of God. And even if you experience it for one split second, it's worth everything, absolutely everything. And that's why he said you would go mad if you stayed here. You would need him so badly your soul would leave your body. And that's that. Okay. And that's why because he wants us to live upon the earth and he wants us to complete the journey of our lives, he doesn't actually show us himself. And it's not cruelty. It's to enable us to live. So he tells Louisa here, I couldn't show you how much I loved you because you'd go mad. In fact, if I showed you, you would not only go mad, you would not be able to continue to live. Your weak nature would be consumed by the fires of love. While he was saying this, Louisa said she felt all confused and annihilated. And she said, I felt myself sinking into the abyss of my nothingness. Now, look at the safety net that we have in the spiritual life, our nothingness. Okay. And so she sinks right into that in order to survive. Because I saw myself all imperfect. Especially I noted my ingratitude and coldness to the many graces that the Lord has given to me. Now, do you see the balance that the Lord has given to her? He's telling her about this unbelievable, unimaginable divine love. And to try and balance it, she looks at her sinfulness and her nothingness to try and survive. But I hope that everything will be for his glory and honour, hoping with firm confidence that in an effort of his love, he may want to conquer my hardness. Now, this hardness, you see, if Louisa had hardness of heart, she wouldn't be in this position. Hardness of heart means your heart is closed to grace and to God and to his word and all the rest of it. So what she means is her inability to open up to all the grace and all the challenge of this relationship. That's what she's talking about. So you have to be very careful in reading these writings that you understand the platform from which he's actually speaking. Otherwise, you'd come to completely wrong conclusions. September the 16th, 1899. The effects and the value of suffering only for God. This morning, my adorable Jesus came, and since I feared it might be the devil, I said to him, allow me to sign your forehead with the sign of the cross. And the devil would disappear instantly if you did that. And in the very act of saying this, I signed him, and so I remained more assured and tranquil. Now, blessed Jesus seemed tired and wanted to rest in me. And since I too felt tired from the sufferings of the past days, especially because of how very few visits he made, I felt the necessity to rest in him. So this is mutual rest. So after arguing for a little while together, he told me, the life of the heart is love. This is the very essence of life. We cannot live without love. We were meant to be conceived in love. We were meant to be nurtured in the womb in love. We were meant to be born in love. We were meant to be reared in love. And when we reached maturity, we were meant to commit ourselves to love and to giving this love and life to others. And we were meant to go from the physical and emotional and human love to divine love. And by the time we would reach the maturity of spirituality, that we would have love to take with us into glory, divine love. So love is everything. This thing is all about love. So he said, the life of the heart is love. Now, heart is used here in the biblical sense, not in the modern sense. Heart meaning your person, your real you. I am like an infirm person who is burning with fever and keeps looking for refreshment, for relief from the fire that devours him. Now, there's a very fascinating image that we're told that Jesus is being devoured by the fire of love. And the people in hell are devoured by the fire of hatred, which, of course, is the exact opposite side. It's absolutely amazing. My fever, he said, is love. But from where do I extract the refreshments and the reliefs which are most suitable for the fire that consumes me? He said, I get them from the pains and the toils suffered by souls beloved to me and those who only do it for love of me. So Jesus said it is the sufferings that we offer only for love of him that actually relieve him. So people like Louisa are able to really offer him real refreshments, and the rest of us have to learn how to do it and gain more courage to do it as well. Ah, yes, he said, these are the reliefs and the refreshments most suitable to me, which cheer me and dampen the fire that consumes me. And after this, he threw himself into my arms, languishing in order to rest. While Jesus rested, I understood many things about the words that he had spoken, especially about suffering for love of him. O coin of inestimable value. Now, right here in volume two, we're introduced to what is later on simply discussed as divine currency. And that is that everything that happens to us on the earth, when we offer it to the Lord in union with his sufferings we gain his infinite merits. And when we enter it into the divine will and offer it at that level, then we have divine currency to save enormous souls, stop wars, mitigate chastisements, and so on. So this divine currency is the other big, big, big thing in the divine will. Divine will, love, divine currency. Okay, and the divine currency is most especially suffering, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual, or social, or political, or national, or international. Whatever the suffering is, united with the sufferings of Jesus, raised to the level of the divine will and offered to the Lord for souls. O coin of inestimable value, she said, if all of us knew it, we would compete with one another to suffer more. But I believe that we're all short-sighted. How right you are. We're all short-sighted in knowing this, in knowing mean in understanding how precious this coin is. And this is why it does not, one does not reach the knowledge of it. Now, it's a very awkward statement. Louisa says, we're all too short-sighted. We don't really grasp the value of this, and therefore we don't use it, and therefore we don't see the fruits that come from it. September the 19th, 1899, we have here a very important long section on the fruits of faith, hope and charity. We're still dealing with foundation materials here. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 13:13, which I gave you before. I want to give you Colossians 3:14. Just to get you started. This morning I was a little disturbed. Oh, she's not allowed to be disturbed, you know. You must remain utterly calm to let the Lord work in it. I was a little disturbed, especially because of the fear that it mightn't be Jesus who comes, but the devil, and that my state may not be the will of God. And while I was in this agitation, my adorable Jesus came and he told me, my daughter, I do not want you to waste time thinking about this. In other words, this has been discerned over and over and over again. And he doesn't want her going back over the same ground. You distract yourself from me and he wants her entire attention. And you cause the food on earth with which to nourish me to be lacking. Now, I say the food on earth because Louisa is on earth and Jesus is looking for a response from people on earth. What I want is that you think only of loving me and of remaining all abandoned in me. Now, that's Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind and with all your being. Note the all every time. So it's total surrender that the Lord is looking for. We find this difficult. We like keeping a little bit for ourselves. I want you to remain all abandoned in me because in this way, you will offer me a food that's very pleasing to me. And not just every now and then, but if you continued like this, you'd be able to do it all the time. You'll see this in the higher volumes that she succeeds. Would this not be the greatest contentment for you, that your will, by being abandoned in me and by loving me, be food for me, your God? Okay, so here you have the foundation material given. It's all developed in the higher volumes. After this, Jesus showed me his heart, which contained three distinct globes of light. 1 John 1:5, God is light, which then formed into a single one. Now, we've heard this before back in October the 14th, okay? The three, faith, hope and love, all become one and are the image of the Blessed Trinity working in us. And Jesus resumed his message and he told me, the globes of light which you see in my heart are the faith, the hope and the charity which I brought upon earth to make suffering man happy by offering them to him as a gift. So these were given to us to enable us to be able to live at the highest level of our being, to live in union with God, and therefore, in spite of our struggles and difficulties, that we'd actually be happy. Now, to you also, I want to make a more special gift. Now, the faith, hope and love is being given to everybody. Okay, a more special one is being given to her. And while he was saying this, many threads of light, we would say rays of light, came out from these globes of light, which inundated my soul like a sort of net. That's why she's using the term threads. Because she's obviously not able to think of a net of light. And I remained inside of it. And Jesus said, here is how I want to occupy your soul. One, first, upon the wings of faith. Look at that marvelous, marvelous expression. And in that light, by plunging yourself into it, you will know and acquire ever more. My book says news. It should be knowledge with understanding, because God never gives knowledge without understanding. Wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge, piety, and the fear of the Lord. So he says, when you plunge yourself with the wings of faith into God, you will know and acquire ever more about him, your God. And by knowing me more, he said, your nothingness will feel also dissolved and you will have no place to lean on. So I want to give you John 3:30. He must increase and I must decrease. OK. Now, notice how often the nothingness is coming up. Your nothingness will feel dissolved and you will have no place to lean on. You, however, rise more and you dive into the second one, which is the immense sea of hope, which is made of all my merits. Look what hope is made of. Why is it that we can hope so much in God? It's because Jesus has acquired everything for us. It's like as if, excuse me for using this awful language, it's like as if he's the supermarket and we can go and take everything we want from him. So this immense sea of hope is made of all my merits that I acquired in the course of my mortal life. And it's also made of the pains of his passion, which, of course, he experienced throughout the whole of his life, which I also gave to man as gift. Only through these can you hope for the immense gift, the immense goods of faith, because there's no other way to obtain them. Now, you need to take this very, very slowly and write these sentences out. There's no other way to obtain them. So he said, first of all, upon the wings of faith, you plunge yourself into God, and there you will acquire ever more knowledge with understanding of who God is. Your own nothingness is completely dissolved in him, and then you rise in the immense sea of hope, and the hope is made up of all the merits of Jesus and all his passion, which is given to us as gift. And he tells us that it is only through these merits of his that you can hope for the immense goods of faith, and there's no other way to obtain them. Now, it's all given to us as gift. But if people think they can do it outside of Christ, and if they think they can do it of their own nothingness, then they're very, very foolish. So, as you avail yourself of these merits of mine, now notice what he's saying, that we have to actually take hold of the merits of Jesus, okay? As you avail yourself of these merits of mine, as if they were your own, your nothing will no longer feel dissolved. And sinking into the abyss of nothingness, look at that, sinking into the abyss of nothingness, but acquiring new life, it will be embellished and enriched in such a way as to draw the very divine gazes upon itself. Now, do you see now why Louisa keeps on going back into her nothingness, no matter what the Lord tells her, and the incredible gifts of love that he gives to her. Her immediate response is to go back into her nothingness, because that's the safe place to be. Okay, so let me go back on this again, because this is incredibly important. Only through the merits of Jesus' life and passion, you can hope for the immense goods of faith, because there's no other way to obtain them. So, as you avail yourself of these merits of mine, Jesus said, as if they were your own, your nothing will no longer feel dissolved, and sinking into the abyss of nothing but acquiring life, it will be embellished and enriched in such a way as to draw the very divine gazes upon itself. So there's Ephesians 2:10, where God's work of art. Then the soul will no longer be timid, but hope will administer to her courage and strength, that is, fortitude, in such a way as to render her stable like a pillar. That's very important. You become one of the pillars in the house of God. You remember in the old world, all temples were built on pillars, and then the roof was put on it. You become stable like a pillar, exposed to all the intemperances of the air, which are the various tribulations of life, and which do not move her even a tiny bit. In other words, you become stable. You become immutable like God, okay, insofar as a creature can. And hope will cause the soul not only to immerse herself without fear into the immense riches of faith, but to make herself the owner of them. I want to give you Philippians chapter 3, verse 7 to 16, where you hear St. Paul, not a timid soul, but with great fortitude and courage, saying that I am reaching out for the prize for which Christ Jesus reached out to me. I'm racing to the finish to claim this prize. I'm letting nothing stand in my way. Okay. And through hope, the soul will reach such a point as to make God himself her own. Now, I don't have to say there's no greater privilege than that. Ah, yes. Hope makes the soul reach wherever she wants. Hope is the door to heaven. Only by means of hope can it be opened, because one who hopes for everything obtains everything. I want to give you Luke 1:37. And I want you to write in the margin of your book, door to heaven. Hope is the door to heaven. Okay. And so the Lord is telling us, you have the key. You have the ability to open this door. St. Therese of Lisieux is famous for having said that you will obtain from God whatever it is you trust him for. If you have confidence in God, you will obtain what you ask. Okay. But many people pray without confidence in God, without real trust, and therefore there's nothing to push God to actually give you what you ask. Then, after the soul has reached the point of making God himself her own, immediately, without any obstacle, she will find herself in the immense ocean of charity. And carrying faith and hope with her, she will immerse herself in it and will form one single thing with me, her God. Wow. Matthew 19:26, John 14:20-21, 1 Corinthians 6:17, and 1 John 4:7. Now, what Jesus has just done there is described how we can enter heaven. And he has described how we can enter heaven on earth. We don't have to wait until we're dead. The mistake that most people make is they say, ah, that'll be okay when I'm dead. It won't, you know. You've been given the privilege of building heaven on earth. So, blessed Jesus continued, if faith is the king, charity is the queen. And hope is like the peacemaking mother who pacifies everything. In fact, with faith and charity, there can be interior disturbance, but hope, being the bond of peace, converts everything into peace. Hope is support. Hope is refreshment. It has just occurred to me to say, faith, hope and love, they represent the Blessed Trinity. So faith represents the Father and hope represents the Son and charity represents the Holy Spirit. So if you go through the Bible, you have the time of the Father in the Old Testament, the time of the Son in the Gospels and the time of the Holy Spirit in the Church. And it's a progression into experiencing heaven on earth. And the Lord wants us to experience this in our own personal lives as well. So everything we have learned, you see, from the church is that we gain everything through Jesus, with him and in him. So hope is our support and hope is our refreshment. And when the soul, rising by means of faith, sees the beauty, the sanctity and the love with which she is loved by God and feels drawn to love him, but in seeing her own insufficiency, how little she does for God and how she should love him but doesn't, she feels discomforted, disturbed and almost doesn't dare to draw near God. Immediately this peacemaking mother of hope comes out. Do you see, Jesus intervenes all the time. He's our saviour. He's our redeemer. He does absolutely everything for us. This peacemaking mother of hope comes out and, placing herself between faith and charity, she begins to perform the office of peacemaker. She makes the soul peaceful again. She pushes her, raises her, gives her new strength. And carrying her before the king of faith and the queen of charity, she excuses the soul. She places a new effusion of her merits before the soul. And she prays them to receive her. To receive her is hope. And faith and charity, with their gazes fixed only on this peacemaking mother, which is hope, so tender and compassionate, receive the soul, and God forms the delight of the soul, and the soul the delight of God. Now, we have seen moments of that between Jesus and Louisa already. Ah, only hope, O holy hope, Louisa said, how admirable you are. I want to give you Ephesians 1:18 and Ephesians 4:4. And I want to give you Colossians 1:27. O holy hope, how admirable you are. I imagine seeing the soul who is possessed by this beautiful hope like a noble wayfarer who walks in order to go and take possession of a land that he will make his whole fortune. But since he is unknown and he journeys through lands which are not his, some deride him, some insult him, some strip him of his clothes, some reach the point of beating him and even of threatening to kill him. And the noble wayfarer, what does he do with these trials? Will he be disturbed? No, never. On the contrary, he will deride those who do all these things to him because, knowing with certainty that the more he suffers, the more he will be honoured and glorified when he comes to take possession of his land. He himself teases the people into tormenting him more. For all of that piece that I've just read, I want to give you Psalm 62. And for what I'm about to read, Colossians 3:15, Philippians 4:7 and verse 9, and Psalm 1:3:1. But the wayfarer is always tranquil. He enjoys the most perfect peace. And what is more, while in the midst of these insults, he remains so calm that while the others are all alert around him, he keeps sleeping in the bosom of his longed for God. That's Psalm 131. Who administers so much peace and so much firmness to this wayfarer in continuing the journey he has undertaken? Certainly it is hope in the eternal goods that will be his. Psalm 42, verses 5 and 11. Psalm 43, verse 5. certainly hope in the eternal goods that will be his. And since they are his, he will overcome everything in order to take possession of them. Now, by thinking that they are his own, he comes to love them. And here is how hope gives rise to charity. So I want to give you Psalm 71, verse 5 and verse 14, Psalm 130, verse 7, and 146, verse 5. Louisa says, who can say then what the light of blessed Jesus makes me see? Psalm 36, verse 9, in your light, Lord, we see light. I would rather have let it pass in silence, but I see that Lady Obedience, laying down her friendly guises of friendship, assumes the aspect of a warrior and is arming his weapons to wage war against me and wound me. Oh, please, she said, do not arm yourself so quickly. Lay down your claws, be quiet, for I will do as you say, as much as I can, and we will always remain friends. So here the priest is ordering Louisa to tell in detail what she has come to understand. Up to now, Louisa has often said, Anno, it's too long, I won't continue. But now she's being forced to actually do it. So I want to give you Romans 5, 5, Romans 8, 24, Romans 12, 12, Romans 15, 4. Paul's letter to Titus, chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, verse 7. 1 Peter 1, 21. Hebrews 6, 11, 18 and 19. Now, when the soul carries herself into the most extensive sea of charity, she experiences ineffable delights and enjoys joys which are unspeakable to the mortal soul. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2:9. I had not seen nor ear heard what God has prepared for those who love him. Everything is love. Her sighs, her heartbeats, her thoughts are as many sonorous voices that she makes resound for her most loving God. Psalm 36, verse 10. Psalm 37, verse 4. These voices are all love, calling him to themselves in such a way that blessed God, drawn and wounded by these most loving voices, responds to them. And it happens that his sighs and his heartbeats, all of his divine being, continuously call the soul to God. So love in the soul draws God, who is love. God, who is love, draws the soul who loves him. And there you have the mystery. Who can say then how wounded the soul is by these voices? How she begins to rave as though taken by a most ardent fever. How she runs, almost made insane, and goes to plunge herself into the loving heart of her beloved to find refreshment, and how she suckles in torrents the divine delights. Okay, I want to give you Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 7, and chapter 7, verse 6, Psalm 37, verse 4, Psalm 145, verse 7, and Psalm 36, verses 8 and 9. The soul becomes inebriated with love, and in her inebriation she makes canticles all of love for her most sweet spouse. But who can say everything that passes between the soul and God? Who can speak about this charity which is God himself? 1 John 4, 7. At this moment, Louisa said, I see an immense light. Now, in all the higher volumes, this immense light is going to be called the divine will, because the divine will is the essence of God. And my mind remains stupefied. It applies itself at one point and then at another, and I try to write it on paper. But I feel I stammer in expressing it. So, not knowing what to do, for now I keep silent. And I believe that Lady Obedience will forgive me this time, because if she wants to get huffy with me, this time she is not in the right. The wrong is all hers for not giving me a more fluent tongue to be able to express it. Have you understood, most reverent Obedience? She says to the priest. And there we'll stop.